From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Temple Grandin believes that being autistic has helped her understand how animals think and behave. Grandin is well known for her work designing humane handling systems for animals. And ever since she was profiled by neurologist Oliver Sacks in 1993, she's been known as, quote, one of the most remarkable autistic people of all. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with her about her new book, Animals in Translation, using the mysteries of autism to decode animal behavior. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks back at Jimmy Page's early career before Led Zeppelin when he was a session musician in London studios. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Temple Grandin, has been able to draw on her own experiences with autism to understand how animals think and behave. Although autism made school and social life difficult, she says it made working with animals easy. She designs humane handling systems for cattle and other animals. Half the cattle in America end their lives in the humane slaughter systems she's designed. When neurologist Oliver Sacks profiled her in 1993, he described her as one of the most remarkable autistic people of all. Grandin's book, Thinking in Pictures, described living with autism and how it connects to her work with animals. Her new book is called Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. She lectures on both autism and animal science and teaches at Colorado State University. I spoke with Temple Grandin about her new book, Animals in Translation. You describe autism as a kind of way station on the road from animals to humans, which puts autistic people in a perfect position to translate animal talk to English. Do you feel that there are things you have more in common with animals than with people?
I think one of the big differences is I don't think in language. I think in pictures. And that's the way an animal's going to think. He's going to think by making associations between different smells, different sights, and sounds. There are no words. Now, obviously, a dog can learn what certain words mean. But if a dog's just trying to, like, figure out, what dogs visited the local fire hydrant, and he's getting smell images, and who was there, when they were there, what their ranking was, how long ago they were there. There's a lot of information on that hydrant, and that involves thinking.
You know, when people compare autistic children to animals, as they have sometimes done, it's usually in the form of an insult. You know, like the child was so wild or so impossible to comprehend or control, they were like an animal. You're making some comparisons between people with autism and animals, but you don't mean this in an insulting way.
Oh, absolutely not. Because what I'm comparing this more to how fear is my main emotion. Fear's the main emotion in animals. The thinking in details. Animals aren't into whole big language-based concepts. They're into details. So is an autistic child. He'll notice a little tiny rip on a couch and get all upset about it. Notice little details that most people don't notice. Animals do the same thing. In my work I do with the meatpacking plants, cattle are not afraid of getting slaughtered. They're afraid of some little reflection, a little chain that jiggles, seeing something moving up ahead, little details. I could take a paper cup and throw it in the chute and just about shut the plant down.
Let's talk about some of these things that you feel that people with autism and animals share. And one of the things you write about in the book is the fear of sudden or loud noises. Go ahead.
People with autism have very acute senses. Like when the fire alarm went off, it hurt my ears. Scratchy clothing was like sandpaper rubbing my nerve endings raw. Animals also have extremely acute senses. I was very interested reading the articles about the tidal wave and how the elephants sensed the wave coming, and they ran with their tourists on top of them to higher ground.
So what are some of the sudden sounds or loud sounds that are very difficult for you?
They are the kind of sounds that out in nature mean danger. Intermittent, high-pitched sounds. I find even now, even though I've been on antidepressant drugs for years, that when a truck backs up in the middle of the night and goes beep, 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 that still makes my heart race. See, the thing is, as an autistic person, my nervous system's all anxious, like looking for predators. Fear, that's what keeps animals alive out there. Fear is, until I took antidepressant medication, was my main emotion, always vigilant.
You know what I was thinking about reading about this in your book? The animal I know best is my cat, and she's terrified of tinfoil. Like if I, when I rip off a piece of tinfoil from the roller, she just runs as fast as she can. It's absolutely terrifying to her.
There's something to do with the sound. And a lot of animals have problems with things like fireworks and thunderstorms. And I think it starts out with it hurting their ears, and then there's certain sounds that just hurt, and there must be something about this tinfoil sound that's hurting that cat's ears.
Now, you also say that intermittent noise can be particularly difficult. And I know that's in a way that goes without saying. I mean, that if there's a recurring noise, if people are working on the street in the middle of the night, there's no way you're ever going to sleep. But tell me how that translates into how you think autistic people respond to intermittent noise, and if that has a corollary for animals.
Well, the problem with intermittent noise mm-hmm. is it keeps triggering the orienting response. Okay, like a deer might hear a noise, and the deer's going to turn his head and turn his eyes and ears towards it. Then he has to make a decision. Do I run away, or do I just keep on grazing? And intermittent noises keep triggering that orienting response. And I think the orienting response is the beginning of consciousness. It's the beginning where you can have thought, because it's not just a reflex. Okay, the deer hears the sound, he turns. Now he has to make a decision. Do I graze or do I run away, rather than just relying on reflexes?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Temple Grandin, and she's an associate professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She is known throughout the country for her work designing humane animal handling systems and for her work improving the quality of life for animals in agricultural settings. Her new book is called Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. She has autism and believes that there are many similarities between certain ways animals think and respond and the way people with autism do.
Well, one of the things about cattle is they're very visually responsive. I found the work with the meatpacking plants said it was what they'd look at, a reflection on shiny metal that jiggles. The chute is too dark, so you have to add some light to light it up. There might be a metal strip going across the floor. Little visual details. That seems to really bother them. Just makes them stop.
Is there an equivalent in your life to that?
Well, I can remember as a child, it rained really hard, and we got a leak in my bedroom, and there was a spot on the ceiling where the roof had leaked. Nothing had fallen down, just kind of a brown, discolored spot. And that made me very afraid. I was afraid that all the furniture upstairs would fall down into my room, and I visualized, TV and couches and stuff crashing down into my room.
So what did your parents do? Did they paint the spot?
Yeah, they fixed it. But, I mean, most kids would not even have noticed that spot. But to me, it was, possible danger.
Right, right. Now, a lot of, as you point out, a lot of children with autism are riveted by the motion of the revolving blades on a fan that's turned on. And you say you have the same response with screensavers. If you're in a room with a screensaver, you can't take your eyes off of it, and there's nothing else you can focus on.
Oh, I have to just keep moving the mouse to get rid of those screensavers. Well, rapid movement attracts attention. Rapid movement makes the predatory animals chase, and it makes the grazing animals run away. Rapid movement makes cattle and horses scared, and it makes lions and tigers and domestic cats chase things. It's very stimulating to the nervous system.
So that's a great example of a connection that you think people with autism and that many animals have, that being riveted or stimulated by that kind of motion.
I think one of the main connections is that normal people, language is how they think and how their brain operates. Animals are going to work with the part of the brain that's subconscious in most people. I call it the primary hard drive of the brain's computer. Visual thinking, smell memories, sound memories, and then they have to put those together into different categories to form concepts. I mean, I've always said I think with what Freud used to call the subconscious. And there's been some interesting research that's now starting to explain how autistic savant skills work. What's happening, it's like having a direct line right into the picture department, and this would be the guy that can draw really well or the guy that can memorize the whole map of a large city, but he can't do much else. It's a real narrow focus with these savant skills. And animals seem to have some similar savant skills. For example, birds, when they migrate, only have to be shown the migration route once by the other birds, and then they remember the whole entire route.
So you're suggesting that information only feeds into, like, one specific part of the brain? Is that what you're
saying? There's a tendency in autism for brains to become specialized.
Mm-hmm.
And in some of the high-functioning Asperger's, you get a brain that actually sort of specializes in language and drops out the visual thinking and the musical thinking. But the other kinds of autistic people, you know, they tend to either be visual specialists. You know, some might be sound specialists. But there's a tendency for the brain to specialize because of abnormalities in the frontal cortex. I mean, recent work done by Eric Corshane out in California has shown that the frontal cortex is all messed up because the neurons that connect the different parts of the brain together, sort of the computer cables that connect all the different brain departments together, have just grown into a big tangle that doesn't connect things up right. So one part tends to specialize. There's also been some really interesting research with people with frontal temporal lobe dementia. This is a type of Alzheimer's disease that destroys the language areas of the brain in the frontal cortex. And as these language areas of the brain get destroyed, in some of these patients, art and music talent has emerged.
So, in animals, the frontal lobes, which deal with language, are much smaller.
Well, of course, animals don't have animals do have smaller frontal lobes, mm-hmm. but they also don't have language.
Right.
So they've got to think with the primary sensory-based information. And let me explain to you how you can form a concept with visual thinking. Okay, when I was a little child, how did I figure out that a dog wasn't a cat? Well, I did it by size. But then when our next-door neighbors bought a small dachshund that was the same size as a cat, okay, why wasn't this dachshund a cat? So I had to find a visual detail that every dog has that none of the cats have. And every dog, no matter how small, has exactly the same nose. So now I could categorize them by what the noses look like. You could also categorize them by barking versus meowing. In other words, what I got to do is take either pictures or take sounds, or I can even take smells. I can categorize them by their smell, cat and dog smell. And then I got to put those pictures or sounds or smells into different categories, sort of like sorting them into different boxes.
And how does that relate to the frontal lobes?
Well, you don't need much frontal lobes in order to do that.
In order to do that. Okay. We're talking about like focusing on things and becoming obsessive on some of the things that you focus on. You write about how it's very difficult for autistic people to filter things out. It might be filtering out a sound, it might be filtering out a picture, or even filtering out a thought. You say you think you don't have a subconscious, that everything's conscious. You can't bury
everything's
anything.
Everything's conscious because when you don't think in language, you have to think with the part of the brain that in most people would be the subconscious. And I have to tell you, I see all the little Freudian things in there. They're sort of like nasty little pop-up ads, and I'm not going to tell you what's on my pop-ups, and I click them off because I don't like them.
But I thought in the book you say you can't click them off. That, for instance, you can't see a violent movie because if somebody is raped or murdered, you can't turn off that image. It's just going to stay there.
Well, some of that stuff, yes. I want to just avoid that. I can click them off, but the problem is they're down there on my hard drive and they keep coming back. So really violent movies I just don't want to see. But I do make a differentiation between kind of cartoon violence. But realistic violence where there's cruelty, that's something I do not want to see.
My guest is Temple Grandin. Her new book is called Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Temple Grandin. Her new book, Animals in Translation, is about how living with autism has helped her understand animal behavior. She designs humane handling systems for animals. You teach college.
Yes, I do.
Are there things that you know your students are going through emotionally that you feel like you are incapable of really understanding?
Well, some of all the romantic stuff, I just don't get into that. And I certainly understand emotions like being nervous and scared, you know, before final exams, you know, being nervous and scared, you know, when I first started teaching classes, that I fully understand. But some of the complex stuff, the subtle stuff, I didn't even know that people had eye signals until I read about them in a book 10 years ago.
What kind of eye signals are you talking about?
Yeah, little, you know, subtle eye signals that somebody's annoyed with you. Basically, the one subtle signal I pick up, and this is something that humans and animals share, is tone of voice. You know, if I think one of my clients might be angry with me, I like to call him up and just listen to what he sounds like, because I can tell if he got this little whine that maybe he's a little angry with me. Animals are extremely sensitive to tone of voice. They also can really clue into the voice of the good person and the voice of the bad person. And let's talk about fear memories. An animal can get a fear memory that of black hats. You know, let's say a person abused a horse wearing a black hat, and the horse was looking right at the black hat. Now the horse is afraid of black hats. Or a dog got hit by a car. You'd expect the dog to be afraid of the car. No, he was afraid of the piece of pavement he was staring at right at the time that he got hit by the car. They make an association, either a sight or a sound. There was another animal that was afraid of nylon ski jackets because he was abused by a person wearing a nylon ski jacket that made a shush, shush kind of sound. So now the animal was afraid of that sound. And an autistic kid, he can get afraid of seeing a little red fire alarm box because you never know when that horrible thing's going to go off and blast out your ears.
Did you have fears like this?
Oh, yes, I did. One of the things that was done with me, I was scared of paper bags popping, and sometimes that was used as a threat to make me behave. And I saw those bags. Yep, I was scared of that.
Who used that as a threat?
Well, my nanny did, and she did a lot of really good things, but that was not one of the good things that she did.
Well, because you were so overwhelmed by fear so much of the time, did fear work as a way to discipline you, or did it just kind of send you off the rails?
Well, there's a point where it just will send you off the rail. I mean, you just get so scared you just can't function. I mean, I've been on antidepressant drugs for 25 years, and if I hadn't got on antidepressant drugs in my early 30s, I mean, I wouldn't be here now, and I wouldn't have done the things that I've done.
You were talking about, how if a horse is abused by somebody wearing a black hat, the horse will become afraid of black hats. So let's take that hypothetical example of the black hat. How would you try to desensitize a horse to that fear?
You can desensitize it, but one of the problems that you have is you can never erase the fear memory. Nature will not let you erase it. It will only allow you to put a lock on the file. Now, if the horse is a high-strung horse, that lock can come off the file really quickly, and it can come back. Now, black hats, difficult one, because I can't eliminate black hats from the horse's environment. I mean, showing that horse would be difficult. Now, let's say a horse was afraid of a certain type of bit he'd been abused with. Now, one of the ways I might be able to correct that would be to change maybe from a jointed snaffle bit to a one-piece solid bit, and that would feel enough different. You see, these memories are very specific. They're real, real, real specific. So I put a different bit in his mouth that feels different. Then I got rid of the feared thing, and I can control what bit I put in the horse's mouth, where I can't eliminate all of the black hats. Now, why did the horse get afraid of black hats? Well, that's what he was looking at. Or you might have a dog that's afraid of Nike sneakers because that's what he was looking at when somebody was whacking on him. You know, it's what the animal associates with the bad thing that happened.
Our director who rides horses says that sometimes if a horse is spooked by something, it's recommended that you kind of take that horse to that source of fear over and over again, I guess, until the horse becomes desensitized. Is that something that you would recommend, is if a horse is spooked by something, introducing it to them, taking them to that source several times so that they...
Well, I would do that. Another thing I want to do with the horse is let's gradually introduce horses to a whole lot of things that might be scary gradually. Like, okay, let's say, you know, people say, oh, my horse was fine at home, and he went berserk over at the horse show. Well, you got three really scary things at the horse show that we need to desensitize that horse to at home before you go to a show: balloons, bikes, and flags. Hmm. Now, flags and balloons are a lot of rapid movement and a lot of high contrast, and the best way to train the animal to that would be to decorate his pasture with flags and balloons and let the horse walk up to these things on his own. And then bikes, you need to just introduce it gradually. They're scary because it's rapid movement and they sneak up on you silently without any noise. And what I want to try to do is get the horse used to a whole lot of things before he just sort of accidentally, you know, sees it out on the trail. But you're still going to have some things that are, might just, you know, unexpectedly, you know, spook a horse. I mean, let's say a horse went up the puddle and just spooked a little bit at a puddle. Yeah, you'd bring him back up to it. Well, you see, that's just a little tiny, you know, hardly just a little tiny fright compared to becoming afraid of a person who beat him up. I mean, it's like you get degrees of scared, and things that were really, really traumatic, it's more difficult to get the horse over it than things that are not traumatic.
You write about being touched. You know, a lot of people with autism don't like being touched, certainly don't like being touched suddenly. And a lot of animals are that way, too. They don't want to be approached suddenly. Some animals don't like to be touched or don't like to be picked up and held. Can you talk about some of the connections that you see there?
Well, the nervous system in an autistic person is very, very oversensitive and hyped up. And they're sort of like a little wild Mustang, you know, it just jumps away when you touch it. But then gradually, if you work on stroking, and I want to emphasize, you stroke animals firmly. Don't pat them. Some animals will interpret that as hitting. You want to stroke. And firm pressure with a stroke is calming. Little tickle touches, that sets off an alarm reaction. Don't do that. Same thing is true with little autistic kids. And then gradually, you can work on desensitizing them to touch, so they'll like hugging.
That's interesting that tickling sets off that reaction. You know, when you have a pet and you tickle them and they kind of go nuts, you don't know whether that's fun nuts or bad nuts.
I would not tickle a pet. I stroke a pet, you know, mimic the motions of the mother animal's tongue. You know, horses like to be, you know, scratched up on the withers. Or sometimes they just like to be scratched because they're itchy. And so they lots of horses really enjoy being scratched.
Temple Grandin will be back in the second half of the show. Her new book is called Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of astrologer Susan Miller's The Year Ahead 2005, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward looks back on the early career of Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page when he was a session musician in London. And we continue our conversation with Temple Grandin about autism and animal behavior.
Leaves are falling all around. Time I was on my way. Thanks to you, I'm much obliged. Such a pleasant stay. But now it's time for me to go. The autumn moon lights my way. But now I smell the rain, and with it pain, and it's heading my way. Sometimes I grow so tired.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Temple Grandin. Her new book, Animals in Translation, is about how living with autism and keeping up with the scientific literature about autism has helped her understand animal behavior. She designs humane handling systems for animals raised for the food industry and teaches at Colorado State University. Her new book is called Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. You know, one of the things you're very famous for, and we talked about this the last time you were on your show, you were on our show, is a chair that you described that you call it like a squeeze chair. And I'm going to ask you to describe it again.
Well, this was modeled after cattle squeeze chute that cattle get in for their vaccinations. When I got into puberty and the hormones hit, I was in a constant state of stage fright all the time. I was like so nervous all the time I couldn't stand it. And I noticed that when they put the cattle in the squeeze chute for their vaccinations, that sometimes they relaxed. So, of course, I went and tried out the squeeze chute. Then I found the pressure relaxed me. And then I built a device that I could get into that works just like a cattle squeeze chute. And it's actually being used in some, therapeutically with some autistic children and adults. A lot of therapists use pressure to help calm down autistic kids. I mean, things like, getting under sofa pillows and cushions, wrapping up in mats, because the deep pressure calms down the nervous system. It's sort of like, wrapping up a baby on a swaddling board.
Or like being hugged, but you wouldn't want to be hugged.
Well, I wanted to feel the good feeling of being hugged, but it was just too overwhelming. And I think it's really important to desensitize young autistic kids. And I want to emphasize that these problems with touch sensitivity are in other disorders as well, not just autism. You work gradually, with firm pressure, and the child will then get to like hugging. You need to work on desensitizing it.
So how old were you when you first found the kind of squeeze cattle chute?
I was 16 then, and this is when the nerves were just tearing me apart. You know, I had headaches, I had colitis. My nervous system was turned on all the time to fight a lion, even though there wasn't any lion to fight. My nervous system was turned on to fight it, and that was due to a biological defect in the nervous system. And some of these people, like me, when they get older, they're going to need a little tiny bit of help from something like Prozac to calm down their anxiety, or they're just not going to be able to function. And I want to emphasize, there's all different types of autism, and some of them are not going to benefit from that drug. And this is one of the problems with the disorder. It's very, very, very variable.
Just one more question about the cattle chute. Did you live near a farm where you found this, or live near a
slaughterhouse? Yeah, I lived near a ranch. I went and visited my aunt out in Arizona, and the cattle chute was on the next door neighbor's ranch.
I see. Okay, now you're talking about medicines and how your nervous system was always on alert, always prepared for danger, and you lived in this constant state of fear until about the age of 33 when you started taking antidepressants. Can you talk a little bit about how antidepressants changed your ability to deal with the world, changed how you felt, how you responded to things?
Well, just imagine if you felt like final exam nerves, or let's say you felt like your very first really, really big, most important interview you ever did nerves. And imagine that that's the way you felt just all the time. And I was just desperate for relief. And I can remember 2 days after taking the antidepressant drug, a lot of that anxiety went away. And I'm going, wow, I really am a believer in biochemistry. And I had kind of resisted the idea of taking medication because I thought it was normal to be that nervous all the time. And this little pill came along and drastically reduced the nerves. It helped me in a whole lot of things because it was so much easier for me to socialize and do things with people because I wasn't, so anxious all the time.
So you at this point are a believer in medications for people with autism if they respond to it.
Well, if they respond to it. Now, I think there's way too many powerful drugs given out way too casually in real little children, and I am against that. Mm-hmm. 2 and 3 and 4 year olds getting real powerful drugs. I'm not a fan of that. But you get into, especially in high-functioning autism, I was one of the types, and this is where you have different types, where the anxiety got worse with age. It got worse and worse and worse with age. That was my type. And the ones that are my type, they're going to need a little bit of help from Prozac or one of the other SSRI drugs, or they're going to be in really big trouble.
Would you ever use negative reinforcement punishment as a way to discipline an animal?
Most of the times I would not, but I would never say never. I would never use punishment on something that's fear-based behavior because that will worsen it. If you want to teach the animal a new skill, like you want to teach a dog a trick, I want to do that all with positive reinforcement. You want to teach the lion or the dolphin at the marine park or the zoo to cooperate with veterinary work. That's all done with positive reinforcement. Totally, totally, totally. There's only one thing where punishment is just about half to use punishment, and that's stopping prey drive behavior. You've got a dog that's killing cats, or you've got a dog that's killing sheep, and they've already done it. I absolutely despise shock collars, and I despise a lot of the things that hunters are doing with shock collars. I think it's totally wrong, but there's one legitimate use for it. Car chasing, jogger chasing, cat killing, deer chasing, anything that's prey drive behavior. And this is not aggression and it's not fear. It's a very special other kind of emotion that the animal has. And you'd want to put the collar on, have the dog wear it for 2 days, and then, because you never want him to find out that the collar did it. And then one day the thunderbolt from the sky blasts him for chasing deer. And that's one of the few situations I would use a punishment. For all kinds of other things, no.
Why is prey-based behavior different?
It's a completely different set of brain circuits. You know, they enjoy, you know, chasing things. It's not aggression. It's not anger. And the brain circuit's different. And this is going to be discussed in detail in the book. We've got a little section in there called the Happy Hunter.
Yeah, and the new book is called Animals in Translation. My guest is the author, Temple Grandin, and she has written in the past about living with autism and about working with animals. She lives with autism. She's an animal scientist who is both a college teacher and works in the agricultural animal industry designing humane systems. And the new book makes connections between animals and people and people with autism in terms of their behavior and their responses.
I want to mention another really important thing on socializing animals. We've got an awful lot of problems today with aggression in dogs, like between strange male dogs. And a lot of this is caused by not socializing the young animals. We get the puppies socialized. We're doing a pretty good job of that. But we also need to get adolescent dogs socialized to other dogs. Because animals that are reared by themselves, that don't have an opportunity to socialize with other animals, can get extremely vicious towards other animals. And this behavior can sometimes be almost impossible to correct. We've got to correct this by raising animals in social groups so they learn social behavior from other animals. Like if you have a horse that's just been in a backyard pasture, and he's never socialized with other horses, and you mix other horses in there with him, he'll try to kick those other horses to death because he hasn't learned the give and take of social behavior. And some of this cannot be corrected. We have to make sure we prevent these problems by raising animals so that they have opportunities to learn social skills with other animals.
Well, apply that to house pets.
Well, let's say you've got a puppy. First thing you want to do is go to a puppy class, and so you socialize it to all the other little puppies. But you also need to get the adolescent dogs socialized. And if they're just on leashes all the time, they don't learn any social behavior. You need to get adolescent dogs actually out in the dog park interacting with each other. You know, when I was a child, all the dogs ran loose. We had no dog bites. We did have dogs hit by cars, unfortunately, but no dog bites, very few dog fights. Because when a new dog came in, when we got our new dog, Andy, you know, as soon as he was 6 months old, and he was running around the neighborhood, Lightning just put him in his place. Lightning was the Frazee's dog that lived next door, and Lightning put Andy in his place. And Andy learned, you know, where he was in the hierarchy. And you didn't get these vicious dog fights that just don't stop because they'd done this social interaction. Now, today, we're going to have to do that in a dog park. But then I think this is one of the reasons we have so much horrible problems with intermale aggression between dogs. And I went to a dog behavior seminar at one of the veterinary conferences, and something like two-thirds of the dogs, they cannot correct this problem. This dog just can't seem to get along with other dogs. And it has to do with how they're raised, and they need to learn social skills, and we need to work on trying to prevent these problems to start with.
My guest is Temple Grandin. Her new book is called Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Temple Grandin. She wrote about living with autism in her first book, Thinking in Pictures. Her new book, Animals in Translation, is about how autism has helped her understand animal behavior. She designs humane handling systems for animals. The last time you were on our show, after the publication of your book, Thinking in Pictures, we talked a little bit about the humane slaughter systems that you had devised for cattle in the meatpacking industry. And you talked a little bit about how you devised those systems and some of the things you look out for. What kind of work are you doing now? Has your work changed at all in the past few years?
It has. So last time I interviewed you, I was strictly working on the engineering side of things and the design side of things. Now I'm working more on what I call the management software for my hardware. For the last 7 years, I've been working with McDonald's and Wendy's and Burger King Corporation on animal welfare auditing. I designed a very simple scoring system where an auditor can go into a plant and determine, you know, how good the welfare is. And it's not somebody's opinion. You watch 100 cattle go through the plant and you count, well, how many cattle out of 100 were mooing and bellowing? Now, that's really bad if they're mooing and bellowing. Well, you're only allowed to have 3 cattle out of 100 mooing and bellowing while they're being handled and they go into the slaughter plant. How many were hit with an electric prod? It used to be all of them. You know, now, most plants, it's only 5 or 10%. How many fall down? How many were rendered insensible on the first attempt? You can measure these things. And I worked with the McDonald's food safety auditors on implementing these measurements. And it's resulted in tremendous improvement. And about 90% of the beef plants are involved in this. There have still been some bad problems in plants that are outside of this audit system. But right now, about 90% of the cattle are part of this audit system.
So in other words, if a lot of the cows are mooing and bellowing, it means something's wrong in the way they're being treated, and the ultimate goal here is to fix how they're being treated.
Well, yes, mooing and bellowing is a sign of pain and fear. I mean, cattle moo and bellow when they're being handled. If you're making them scared, or you're pinching them in some piece of equipment, or you're shocking them with an electric prod, those are all things that make them moo and bellow. And when we first started, there was lots of mooing and bellowing going on. Now you go into a plant that's really well run and it's almost silent. And the plants had to fix a whole lot of little things, like add a light to get rid of a dark entrance, move a light to get rid of a reflection, add a piece of solid metal to block seeing some moving equipment. And when they made these small changes, and the cattle were no longer scared, they were now willing to walk through the equipment, they also had to do a lot of training. They also had to do a much better job on just maintaining their equipment.
You mentioned shadows. Even a shadow can be very upsetting to cattle.
It'll just make them stop, especially a moving shadow. Mm-hmm. If the shadow's moving, they'll just stop and they won't want to walk over it.
Because they are afraid of it?
It attracts their attention, and they have to look at it, determine that it's not dangerous, and then walk over it. But the problem is you don't have time in a busy slaughter plant to let all the cattle look at it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what tends to happen is you try to drive the cattle forward. They see the shadow, then they just turn back, and they keep turning back and turning back and turning back, and then they end up just getting all excited because then the person keeps trying to drive them forward, and they just keep turning back at the shadow.
Let me ask you a question I know you've been asked a million times. You obviously love animals. You feel very specially connected to animals. Yet you work in the design of humane slaughter systems, and some people might say, well, there's nothing humane about slaughter. If you really loved the animals, you'd have nothing to do with their slaughter for chopped meat.
Well, one of the things is the cattle that we raise for food have never even been bred if we hadn't bred them. And they wouldn't have lived at all. But I feel very strongly that we owe these animals a decent life. And some of my biggest concerns now, especially in animals like chickens and pigs, are problems with genetics. And I'm not talking about bioengineering. I'm talking about old-fashioned breeding, where you over-select for single traits like rapid growth, and then you get problems like lameness. I think these are some of the worst animal welfare problems, and I'm very, very concerned about that. And those kind of problems need to be corrected. You know, we raise these animals, we must give them a decent life. I think that's extremely important. They feel pain, they feel fear. That has been scientifically proven.
And what about a decent death? What does that mean to you for animals?
It means they just walk up the chute and bang, it's done, and they don't know what's happened. That would be a decent death.
A death without a lot of fear.
Just walk up the chute, bang, it's done. Right now, looking at some of the research, there is some, they get a little bit scared when they go in to get vaccinations. And I compiled a whole lot of studies together, and the amount of stress hormone that was secreted was measured at the slaughter plant. It was also measured in a chute where they just went in to be held, like for vaccinations. and the levels of stress hormone were the same at the slaughter plant as back on the farm in a chute that would be used to hold cattle for vaccinations.
You know, a little earlier we were talking about the recommendations you'd give parents of children with autism. And I'm wondering if you'd recommend pets for children.
You know, some autistic children, it would be good. I would recommend against getting a small, delicate dog that the child might hurt. There's sometimes a tendency for them to grab and squeeze the animal too tight because they don't know how to stroke the animal the way the animal wants to be stroked. You know, in some cases, a pet can be good because a friendly dog will always want to keep interacting. You see, and you want to try to get autistic kids to interact and then interact back.
So not all kids would probably do well with pets, and you have to be careful of the pet.
With real young autistic children, you need to make sure that the child doesn't hurt the pet.
Right. Okay. What has it been like for you to become, you know, reasonably famous? You're very well known within your field, and now you're also well known outside of your field because of your work, because of your insights into autism and animals, because of your previous book, Thinking in Pictures, and now you have a new book, Animals in Translation. Is that level of recognition comfortable for you, or has it kind of opened the door to new things to worry about?
Well, I just want to share my knowledge. I think I have knowledge that's, you know, beneficial to people. One of the things I learned a lot long time ago, and this is one myth that I learned about Icarus, you know, they flew too high to the sun and the wings melted and he fell in the ocean because he got hubris. Seen a lot of people in business, you know, get too big a head. They think they got, you know, such a big head, stuff like that. Don't ever let yourself get that way. And I still do plenty of things where I got to go out in a job and we got to stay in a really, really junky motel. And that's just fine because that just keeps my head where it should be.
You're doing a lot of consulting now for Wendy's, McDonald's, other companies like that. Do you eat hamburgers?
Absolutely, I eat them. I happen to have the kind of metabolism where if I don't get some animal protein, I don't feel right. That seems to be something our whole family seems to have this problem. My mother's the same way. We had to stay at this hotel where they just had muffins on the breakfast bar, and then we had to go do some talks. And I know we had to go find a restaurant that serves some eggs or, you know, sausage, you know, things that some animal protein.
Now, I've only left you a minute for this answer because we're out of time. But, you know, you've spoken about how you think people with autism don't think in words, they think in pictures. But we're listening to you speak, and you're incredibly articulate. So it seems like a real contradiction. If you don't think in words, how can you possibly speak so eloquently?
Well, when I was talking about the horses, I'm actually seeing videotapes right now in my mind of the horse, Goldie, and I'm seeing her. I'm actually back there now. I'm holding her. I remember holding her when she was being shod, have her shoes put on, and she was just absolutely fine. I'm like narrating the videotapes that I'm bringing up out of my visual memories. Language narrates the videos that are in my mind.
And you've been able to master language itself.
Yeah, and I get better and better and better. Because another thing about being autistic, there's no magic turning point. It's a gradual emergence. You just keep learning more and more and more and more. It's like you never really grow up. I didn't even feel I was a grown-up adult until I was 45.
Temple Grandin, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Temple Grandin's new book is called Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward considers Jimmy Page's early career before Led Zeppelin when he was a session guitarist in London studios. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Since the earliest days of rock and roll, the session musicians who have played on hits have rarely gotten any credit, and for many of them, that's just how they like it. Few of them go on to be stars, but one big exception is Jimmy Page, the British guitarist who began in London's studios and graduated to stadiums with Led Zeppelin. Ed Ward tells us about Jimmy Page's early years.
I'm not content to be with you in the daytime. Girl, I want to be with you all of the time.
The question of whether or not Dave Davies actually played the slabs of guitar on two of the Kinks' first hits, All Day and All of the Night and You Really Got Me, has been a subject of heated debate, mostly because the other contender has been Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin fame. Page himself has never been sure, and why should he be, since he was one of the most prolific session guitarists in London? Actually, it seems that he did play on at least All Day and All of the Night, as well as The Who's Can't Explain and Tom Jones' It's Not Unusual. In case that seems odd, consider that the record companies back then didn't think this rock and roll fad was going to last, nor did they think that the groups were going to stick together. Getting as many hits as often as possible was the name of the game, and making them sound as good as possible, whether the band was that good or not, was really important. So along with the keyboard player Nicky Hopkin, Jimmy Page was all over the place. He was a teenage guitar prodigy, he understood this music, and he worked fast. No second takes for Page. When he knew the song, he was ready to go. A day's work, but a solo like the one on the first year's Leave My Kitten Alone was a bit avant-garde for 1964, and that was probably just one of the factors that didn't sell that record. It's an early showcase for one of Page's favorite guitars, the one he called the Black Beauty, a Gibson Les Paul with specially filed down frets, which made it easier for him to move his fingers around. Having worked on famous bands' records, he was obviously going to be called in when one of them sold a song to another group, as The Who did to a band called Les Fleurs de Lis. Although he worked for everyone, Jimmy Page was a particular favorite of the Rolling Stones manager-producer Andrew Luke Oldham, and occasionally he'd work with him not only as a session guitarist, but as a producer, too.
Rivers were made for flowing, so why not let them flow? People were made for showing, so why not let them show a little laughter, show a little smile, 'cause we started on the last mile.
If the voice sounds familiar, it might be because this beautiful young woman was going to be Oldham's next Marianne Faithfull, except that her singing wasn't so hot. Nor were the songs Page and Oldham wrote for her. Her next stop would be New York, where Nico joined the Velvet Underground. By 1966, Page was getting itchy. He'd already turned down an offer to replace Eric Clapton in the Yardbirds, letting Jeff Beck take the job, but he was reconsidering. In the meanwhile, his expertise at crafting a hook was responsible for one gigantic hit, recorded in 1965, but not released for almost a year afterwards. Four notes grab your ear right away, and don't let go for 4 minutes.
Through my window today, could have tripped out easy, but I've changed my way. It'll take time, I know it, but in a while you're gonna be mine, I know it. We're doing it in style, 'cause I made my
In 1966, he finally decided to join the Yardbirds, first on bass, then as second lead guitar. Out of the studios and playing at last in front of audiences, Jimmy Page wasn't going to be anonymous anymore.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Led Zeppelin will be getting a Lifetime Achievement Award at this year's Grammys. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, let the sun beat down upon my face.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The taboo against using children as soldiers has been broken in many countries. Children are fighting in military, rebel, and terrorist groups. They are victims and perpetrators of atrocities. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Brookings fellow P.W. Singer about his new book, Children at War. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.